Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, October 3rd. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Feather Alert issued for missing 26-year-old last seen in McKinleyville. Humboldt opens commercial areas to multifamily housing. And Please Don't Let Me Die, emergency care refused by Providence St. Joseph's, forces local woman to risk her life. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Roy Sadaki, a 26-year-old from McKinleyville, has been missing since September 22nd. He was last seen around noon in McKinleyville and is believed to be on foot. A Feather Alert has been activated by the California Highway Patrol in coordination with the Arcata Police Department due to concerns about his well-being. KMUD News spoke with Heather Allen, Roy's mother, about the last time she had contact with her son.
I'm not from here. I'm from Reading. And the last time I heard from my son was at about 8:30 on Sunday evening. I did not get the text until the next morning, but it was an alarming text. Like, I don't want to go into detail what was said, but he was definitely reaching out, and none of his friends or family have heard from him since right around that same time.
Allen, worried about her son, has been unable to locate Roy despite family and friends searching for the missing man, aided by law enforcement.
I have contacted the Sheriff's Department and the Police Department, and they are assisting me and my family looking for Roy. Roy is in no way, shape, or form being sought after for any criminal questioning or anything ugly that's been posted on Facebook. Like, he was last known to be wearing either black jogger shorts or a red and black hoodie.
Though rumors persisted after the initial search for Roy began, Allen reiterated that Roy is only being sought because he has been deemed at risk and missing.
I'm reaching out because I need to clarify that Roy has never had any kind of criminal history, and he's an upstanding citizen.
As the days tick by, the worried mother clings to the hope that Roy will be found alive and well.
Right now, I pray that he's confused and doesn't know how to reach me. Roy's never gone this long without contacting, and so there's something, you know, that's not right. And the last person he was known to have been with, she has a history of taking his cell phone from him. And so I feel like that's what has happened, and that's why he doesn't have his cell phone.
Like many people reliant on cell phones to store contact information, Allen believes that without his phone, Roy may not know how to contact his family to let them know of his whereabouts.
So without his cell phone, he wouldn't know how to contact his mom, his sisters.
Additionally, based on the last message Allen received from her son, coupled with online rumors, Allen is afraid that Roy could believe he's in some sort of trouble, which is not the case, Allen says. If Roy is listening, his mother has a message for him.
Roy, contact the Sheriff's Department, son, so that they can get in touch with me. You're not in trouble at all. We're worried about you. We love you. And I need to find you, son. Please make yourself known to anybody, any business. We put fires up everywhere. Contact the fire department. Contact the local hospital. Contact anybody that can get in touch with me. There's a nationwide BOLO for my son. It's just for his safety. He's not in trouble.
Just 3 days into the search for Roy, Allen was already feeling the weight of exhaustion. Each minute that Roy remained missing only deepened the emotional strain on his worried mother.
Yeah, I'm running on fumes at this point, and as the time passes on, you know, I need to find my son. It's been 3 days since he's made contact, and that is the longest he's ever gone without contacting any friends or family members. This is not typical behavior for him.
It has now been 11 days since Roy was last seen.
And I'm sure any mother and father can sympathize with my pain. I want my son home. I want him home. I want him well, and I want him home.
Alan is asking for the public's help searching for her son.
So Roy is about 5'10". He's of a slender, muscular build. He's not really thick. He's tall and kind of wiry, if you will. He's got shoulder-length, curly, dark hair. He's been known to wear a beanie or a baseball hat. Typically wears a hoodie, dark in color. He's got a bounce to his step. His demeanor is very pleasant, very welcoming, very, you know, everybody that crosses his path says that he's got really good energy. My son is very sensitive and a caring person. He's never had any kind of violent behaviors or attitudes in the past or, you know, ever. He's got a beautiful smile. His eyes smile. He's got a dimple. If you've seen any of the posters that we post, that's a good depiction of what my son, what you would encounter if you were approached by him. He's not intimidating. He doesn't have a drug history. He's very approachable. He's very pleasant and approachable.
Authorities are urging anyone with information about Roy Sadeke's whereabouts to contact 911 or the McKinleyville Sheriff's Station at 707-839-6600. With housing in high demand and short supply, Humboldt County is expanding opportunities for developing it. Daniel Mintz reports.
The state and the county are scrambling to address a housing shortage, and Humboldt's Board of Supervisors has approved a new law that allows housing up to 30 units per acre in commercial areas. At their October 1st meeting, supervisors approved an ordinance opening commercial areas to housing development. The new law responds to state legislation, Senate Bill 6. After some debate, supervisors agreed to allow the development even in areas without public water and sewer services. Last summer, the county's Planning Commission approved a draft version of the ordinance with a maximum density level of 30 units per acre, but general application of that density was questioned by 3rd District Supervisor Mike Wilson.
Frankly, if you're opening up sort of multifamily housing, which we all want to have more of, but in locations where you don't have the kinds of services such as a store or any of those sorts of things, then you have isolated communities, which we're having, for instance, our affordable housing project in Samoa, for instance. Very isolated is what happens when we have a very NIMBY perspective on affordable housing. You end up having developments in areas where we don't have bus service, you don't have a store, and you're really isolating communities.
Planning Director John Ford said the ordinance focuses on areas that are already developed with commercial uses and largely within community services districts. But he noted the rural nature of Humboldt County, which he said, quote, does have some population centers that are scattered throughout and may not be within an urban cluster. 2nd District Supervisor Michelle Bushnell's district includes somewhat developed areas without public services. She asked Ford if Wilson's proposed restrictions would exclude them.
I'm curious about for the residential and commercial, like the Cooks Valley area, which is also mixed, it's residential and commercial, and would the new language that he is proposing exclude those areas?
Cooks Valley, yes, because it's not within it has communities, it doesn't have water and sewer.
It doesn't, you're correct, but yeah. It has, there is many residentials there and there's also commercial there, which is vacant right now and could be converted to housing very easily and already has sewer and water to the buildings because that's required for commercial. And so I'm not for the very unincorporated areas, especially in my district, where housing could be appropriate there, I'm not feeling his language change.
Considering the debate, Ford was asked about the Planning Commission's discussions on the ordinance. Ford said parking and housing density were top issues.
The commission struggled with parking and wanted to see really the amount of parking be minimized where it made sense to eliminate parking to allow that to occur. The kind of the compromise was relative to within a half mile of a transit stop and for affordable housing that no parking would be required. Again, parking could be provided, but it's not required. I think the commission also struggled with the number of units, and after they had taken action on the tiny home village, they settled that 30 units per acre was probably appropriate.
After some discussion, supervisors agreed to remove parking requirements for all housing near public transit service. The disagreement over allowing housing development in unserviced areas was resolved by adding a requirement for a discretionary permit process in those cases. Supervisors minus First District Supervisor Natalie Arroyo, who was absent, unanimously approved the ordinance. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
State Attorney General has filed a lawsuit against Providence St. Joseph after the Eureka Hospital refused emergency treatment to a patient in need of an emergency abortion, citing their policy. Ryan Hudson reports.
California Attorney General Rob Bonta has filed a lawsuit and an injunction against Providence St. Joseph Hospital in Eureka, accusing the hospital of violating state laws by refusing to provide emergency abortion care during obstetric emergencies. AG Bonta is seeking a preliminary injunction against the hospital to ensure patients like Anna Nuslock receive timely emergency care, including emergency reproductive care if it includes an abortion. Bonta's office has said they believe this to be the first lawsuit in California filed against a hospital under the Emergency Services Law, which mandates hospitals to provide care, quote, necessary to relieve or eliminate the emergency medical condition, unquote. Eureka resident Anna Nuslock was 15 weeks pregnant with twins when her water broke prematurely with devastating consequences. Nuslock was told by her doctor at St. Joseph Hospital that they were prohibited from performing the emergency abortion if her twins still had any signs of heart tones, despite her own life being at risk and the pregnancy no longer being viable, according to doctors at UC San Francisco. Anna Nuslock explained her experience, telling reporters at the press conference.
I am here today to tell my story for one simple reason. Because I don't want other people in my community to experience the same life-threatening trauma that I experienced. I was denied the emergency abortion care that I needed because of a hospital policy that discriminates against pregnant people. I rushed to Providence Hospital, and almost immediately it was determined that my first daughter, Twin A, was not going to survive. And there was a moment that we had a sliver of hope that Twin B had a chance, and I was willing to do anything to hang on to that chance and keep my baby alive. The doctor at Providence called UCSF to consult a specialist. And that is when the last of my hopes were dashed, and we learned that neither of our daughters were going to survive. UCSF was clear, and the doctor at Providence agreed, without abortion care, I risked infection or hemorrhage, both of which are so dangerous to my health and my life. And these risks increased with every minute that passed. I needed an abortion to protect myself against these risks. And I needed an abortion so that my husband didn't lose both of his daughters and his wife in one night.
Despite her doctor at St. Joe's reportedly being in agreement with UC San Francisco's recommended course of treatment, Dr. Sarah McGraw at St. Joe's informed Anna Nuslock that she could not receive the treatment recommended despite the non-viability of her pregnancy and the life-threatening risks to Nuslock. Providence denied her an abortion, citing hospital policy against providing care while a fetal heartbeat was detectable.
But despite the agreement of my doctors that I needed an abortion, I was told I could not receive emergency abortion care while at Providence because of hospital policy. That policy, I was told, prohibited any medical intervention so long as my daughters still had heart tones, unless it was determined that my life was sufficiently at risk. My doctor recommended that I be helicoptered to UCSF for emergency abortion care, But given the $40,000 cost and the fact that I would have to go alone without my husband, that option was not feasible to me. I asked if we could drive to UCSF instead, and my doctor responded, if you try and drive, you will hemorrhage and you will die before you get somewhere that can help you. I'll never forget looking at my doctor, just tears streaming down my face, my heart shattered into a million pieces, and just pleading with her, don't let me die.
On the way out the door, a St. Joseph's nurse handed Nislok a bucket full of towels, telling her to take the mop-up bucket with her on the way to Mad River Hospital in Arcata, quote, in case something happens in the car, unquote. Nislok traveled 12 miles to Mad River Community Hospital, where when she arrived, she was already severely hemorrhaging on the hospital gurney. She finally received the emergency care both recommended and refused by a doctor at St. Joe's. Providence's policy, which the hospital declined to provide for review upon our request, prohibits qualified doctors from providing life-saving or stabilizing emergency treatment when doing so would terminate a pregnancy, even when the pregnancy is not viable, due to the detection of a fetal heart tone. According to the Attorney General's statement during the press conference, not only does this violate California law, but this policy also discriminates against pregnant patients, allowing the hospital to make healthcare decisions for them and against their best interests. Still, when reached for comment, Providence told us, treatments and medications for the purpose of treating a serious health condition of a pregnant woman are permitted even if the consequence is the termination of a pregnancy, unquote. Additionally, the statement read, quote, Providence hospitals abide by applicable federal and state laws specifically, including the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, unquote. A further statement supplied by Chief Executive Gary Olney read, quote, this was a tragic situation that did not meet our high standards for safe, quality, compassionate care. We are immediately revisiting our training, education, and escalation processes in emergency medical situations to ensure that this does not happen again and to ensure that our care teams have the training and support they need to deliver the best possible care for each patient we serve, unquote. One staff member from St. Joseph Hospital underscored the concern that they say many doctors and nurses under the umbrella of the Catholic healthcare conglomerate share, but seldom speak of. This employee of Providence St. Joseph in Eureka told us, quote, the problem is that Providence has a monopoly on services where their Catholic doctrine mandates treatment options that go against many other views or, in this case, present life-altering scenarios. It wouldn't be such a big deal if there was local competition, but there really isn't, especially with Mad River shuttering their own services soon. What happens then, they said, is shameful approaches to doing what is best for the community and for patients due to their religious doctrines. You can't have a monopoly and doctrines, they told us. To make matters in Humboldt County more dire, local Mad River Community Hospital, where Nislok was ultimately treated, is planning to close its labor and delivery unit this month, leaving St. Joe's as the only hospital equipped with a trauma center and delivery unit for many, many miles in any direction. This scenario, weighing the life of a patient against the comforts of a doctor or hospital, is not uncommon with states with abortion bans. However, California Attorney General Rob Bonta said that Nislok's case showed that they can happen, quote, even in California, a place that is very strongly pro-choice, unquote. For KMUD News, this is Ryan Hudson.
This week is the second national Week Without Driving, where those who normally travel by car are challenged to use alternative modes of transportation from September 30th to October 6th.
My name is Colin Fisk, and I am the executive director of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities. We are a nonprofit organization. We're based in Arcata and work throughout Humboldt County and sometimes in the surrounding counties to promote safe and equitable and sustainable modes of transportation, like walking and biking and riding the bus.
Fisk shared the details about the Week Without Driving Challenge.
This is the second national Week Without Driving. The Week Without Driving started a few years ago up in Washington State and then went national. And it's a time where elected leaders, but also other local officials or just any member of the community who wants to participate, can take a pledge to try to avoid driving for the week. And it's really meant to highlight the fact that we do have a lot of non-drivers in our communities. And sometimes they may not be as visible in, you know, say, city council chambers or at the Board of Supervisors or where people are making the decisions, but they do exist. Non-drivers are everywhere. They are folks who have disabilities. They are folks who are older or younger and can't drive for those reasons, or because, as I mentioned earlier, they can't afford a vehicle. And so, you know, we can talk about the statistics, but this week is really meant to give decision makers and community members a sort of firsthand look at what life can actually be like for folks in our communities who don't have access to a vehicle, who are non-drive, and it can be really eye-opening.
Encouraging alternate transportation can highlight the challenges and safety issues faced by those who do not drive.
You know, a lot of our communities were built in the last, say, 75 to 100 years, which means that they were built around the car. And the idea that folks would have cars and drive most places. And so that does present challenges for using other modes of transportation, including the fact that people are more spread out, so they may be farther away from, you know, jobs and school and groceries and healthcare and all those kinds of things. That makes it more difficult. And just having lower densities makes it harder to support really high-quality public transit. And then there just may be missing infrastructure. So in a lot of places, kind of the only real infrastructure is a road that's designed for cars and not really places for bikes and pedestrians and so forth. But that being said, you know, a large portion of the population in our region does live in small towns and cities, and those places have a lot of potential for, you know, improving the infrastructure and improving the density a bit so that it's much more manageable to get around by walking and biking and by the bus.
Though many may assume that environmental impacts are the motivation behind the challenge, identifying accessibility issues and safety also play key roles in the challenge.
There's a number of reasons. You know, there are environmental reasons, to be sure. Public transit and walking and biking just have a much lower environmental footprint than driving a single occupant vehicle. The largest source of emissions harming our climate comes from the transportation sector, and most of those are just from individual personal vehicles. And so it's really critical to meet our climate crisis, you know, that we drive less and walk and bike and take the bus more. There's also a huge safety crisis, both nationally and locally. And, you know, folks just regularly being killed and seriously injured on our streets. And so, you know, making sure that we have safer infrastructure that reduces and hopefully eliminates those tragedies on our streets is really important to us, partly because, of course, we want more people to be out there and to feel comfortable, you know, for example, walking and biking, but also because a lot of folks already do that even though the infrastructure may be dangerous. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but, you know, we hear a lot from people who do have cars that, you know, they kind of assume that everyone around here has a car and drives to get places. But in fact, we know that there are at least 15,000 adults in Humboldt County without a driver's license, and a lot more people than that who may have a license but don't drive or can't drive because they can't afford a car, for example, or they can't afford gas. And so there's a lot of folks who are forced to get around whether they want to or not, using other modes of transportation. And these are members of our community, and we really think that they should have a voice and they should be able to move around safely and conveniently and comfortably like everyone else.
Local officials were among those who took part in the Week Without Driving Challenge last year, providing feedback to the challenges faced here in Humboldt County.
That's right. We had a number of elected officials last year, also a few this year, and a lot of agency staff and other leaders in the community. And, I think we got a number of interesting types of feedback. Certainly, I think it showed or highlighted for people, you know, what the difficulties are. And I do want to say that, you know, if you live in certain areas of the county, it may be pretty straightforward and easy to take the bus or to walk or to bike places. But if you live in other areas, or if you have to get to other areas that aren't well served by those modes, it really can be a problem. And so, you know, we certainly saw people reflecting on the lack of safe infrastructure in places, on the need for more bus service, more frequent bus service, more bus service at nights and weekends and that kind of thing. And these are things that, you know, we all know, but having to be faced with it, not having the option of driving, really brings it home to people. You know, we actually had someone participate last year, an elected official who's on the Humboldt Transit Authority Board of Directors, and couldn't make it to the board meeting because the bus didn't come early enough where she lived. And so, you know, that was, I think a little eye-opening for everybody.
In addition to officials learning firsthand the challenges those using alternative transportation face, walk audits provide key information. A walk audit took place yesterday, Wednesday, October 2nd, and another is scheduled for this Saturday, October 5th, from 5 to 6 p.m., beginning at 5th and O Streets in Eureka.
Yeah, so a walk audit is, it's basically just getting together with a group of people and walking. And I should say, when I talk about walking, I'm also including folks in wheelchairs and other mobility devices, so, you know, walking or rolling. And we kind of just walk together along a certain route and really try to be mindful of what are the features of the environment around us that affect the safety, but also the comfort and the accessibility of the pedestrian environment. And so that, and then, you know, we'll take notes and we take pictures and we, you know, gather everyone's feedback and then kind of make up a little report about what the findings are. And hopefully that informs future decisions to improve, you know, the safety and comfort of the street.
The walk audit areas were selected due to the areas around 4th and 5th Street corridor of Broadway and Highway 101, where many safety issues arise.
You know, the U.S. 101 corridor through Eureka with Broadway, 4th and 5th Streets is really kind of the epicenter of the safety crisis for pedestrians and bicyclists in our area. And so we really want to kind of focus on some specific locations in that corridor and identify some specific issues and things that might be able to be done about it. So encourage anybody to, anyone who walks or bikes or drives in Eureka or takes the bus to attend.
Though there's many reasons a person may choose alternative forms of transportation, access and safety should be a priority for all residents, Fisk said. For more information, visit weekwithoutdriving.org. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mentz and Ryan Hudson. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see related stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.